The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry today. We thank you so much for listening. We'll hear your remembrances from Prince all hour today. How did his music affect your life?
My name is Lisa. I'm calling from Pennsylvania. I grew up listening to Prince. I loved singing and dancing in my room and watching his music videos on MTV. He greatly influenced my taste in music.
Later on this hour, we're going to talk to Mabeen Azhar. He's creator of the 2015 BBC documentary, Hunting for Prince's Vault. And it's a story that might give comfort to Prince fans, thousands and thousands of hours of unreleased Prince music. But first, on this Earth Day, it's time for some Earth optics at the UN.
By the very act of signing today, the power to build a better world is in your hands. Thank you very much for your leadership and commitment. Thank you. Merci beaucoup.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking at the signing ceremony today. 163 countries have signed up for the Paris Climate Accord. It's a day for policymakers and citizens all over the world to question exactly how their countries are going to meet aggressive climate targets over the next 30 years to limit warming and sea level rise. And so if you're thinking about climate emissions and resources and fuel and air conditioning and water, it is a good day to ask then, why exactly are they building luxury golf courses in the middle of the desert in Dubai? In a few minutes, a Vice investigation goes to Dubai to look at the labor practices used to build Dubai's luxury playgrounds, including one involving Donald Trump. But first, here in New York, world leaders are betting that even oil-rich countries like the UAE and oil-consuming countries like the U.S. can make the Paris Agreement for real. It's the first major global agreement to stop climate change since the 1997 Kyoto Protocol. Now, the United States Senate never ratified the Kyoto Treaty, and ratification isn't just semantics. Here, President Obama is trying for a de facto ratification by executive order because the Senate still isn't interested. And the Paris Agreement won't go into effect until at least 55 countries, who also account for 55% of emissions, can ratify it and submit those plans to reduce their carbon emissions. But the carbon reduction plans are voluntary, and that has skeptics from within the scientific community questioning just how effective the agreement can be. Dr. David Nabarro is special advisor on the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development at the UN, and he joins me now from the United Nations. Dr. Nabarro, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, today is largely a photo op, the signing of this grand agreement. So given the photo op as a time when the hard work begins, what is the immediate road ahead given all of the countries that are yet to submit final climate plans and final carbon reduction plans?
When we're trying to change the way in which the world addresses a big problem, the first thing we have to do is to get the nations through their leaders to agree to the master plan. There is already an obligation on countries to be implementing the effort that's needed.
With a lack of enforcement implicit in the deal, how confident are you that pressure remains sufficient on countries to drive those countries to produce credible and accountable plans eventually? Because many countries haven't yet done so.
The evidence of global warming is all around us. It's happening at a pace that surprises even the most hardened climate scientists. Just the records are being shattered all the time. Countries everywhere recognize they've got to act. The issue is, can they act in concert and can they act quickly enough? And the job is for the rest of us in the international system to make sure that they are monitored closely and that they do fulfill their obligations, both in terms of action to reduce carbon emission, that's changing the way they make energy and so on, and secondly, getting money to poor countries, particularly small islands, that are suffering because of increasingly irregular weather.
Well, Dr. Nabarro, you mentioned climate scientists and even climate skeptics. Here's a hardened climate scientist who is skeptical of this deal. You've probably heard of him. He's Dr. James Hansen, formerly with NASA, currently with the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He's been speaking out about the deal that you're helping to sign today.
It's the same old thing that was tried in Kyoto, asking each country to promise, oh, I'll reduce my emissions, I will cap my emissions, I'll reduce them 20% or whatever they decide is their they can do. This is half-assed and it's half-baked. It's half-assed because there's no way to make it global. And it's half-baked because there's no enforcement mechanism.
Well, there is no global police, and the UN is the next best thing, but there's one hardened climate scientist who says there really is no enforcement.
So, of course, this gentleman is welcome to say what he says. I'd just love to sit opposite him and say, what are you doing about three generations ahead, your children's children's children? What are you doing to try to make sure that they have a decent life? We have nothing else except for a global treaty mechanism to enforce. And that's, frankly, what we're all pursuing now. And I'll bet you that as a result of this signing that happens today, we will see action everywhere to change the way we live and to change the way we do business. And we'll show that we can have a climate-compatible life and enough food and enough jobs for everybody without having to go on producing carbon and making this earth hotter and hotter.
Dr. David Nabarro, Special Advisor on the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development at the UN. Dr. Nabarro, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, as we said before, if there's one thing that climate scientists probably would agree on, it's that building golf courses in the middle of the desert probably isn't the best idea. But the Dubai that we see on television, well, it does look like paradise. Sheikh Zayed Road is one of the most famous landmarks in the capital of the United Arab Emirates. It's lined with towering skyscrapers, luxury hotels, and golf courses. In the shadow of that strip, though, lies the Dubai that we don't see, slums, housing the workers who build that luxury. Migrant workers from countries like Bangladesh and Pakistan come to the UAE with the promise of a better life. But a Vice investigation discovered migrant workers receiving poor pay, squalid living conditions, many found to be constructing a golf course bearing the name of a presidential candidate who's been doing business in the UAE.
Well, I think that Dubai is very solid.
Our airports are third world. I went to Dubai. They have an airport, the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Ben Anderson is senior producer and correspondent for Vice, and we spoke with him about migrant workers in Dubai constructing the Trump International Golf Course.
Well, there are 5 million migrant laborers in the UAE at any one time, and the vast majority are told they're going to get a salary before they leave their home countries. On arrival, their passports are often taken away. They're charged a visa fee, which is illegal, often $1,500 to $2,000. And then the salary they get is much less than the salary they were promised. And often there are other costs, accommodation, safety equipment, food that they didn't anticipate. So they straight away find themselves in a situation where it might take them 2 years of working. And this is working 6 days a week, 10 to 12 hours a day, often in the blazing sun, just to break even. 2 years just to pay back the debt they accrued to get to that job in the first place.
You went to some of the camps, I'll call them slums, where thousands of these workers live. What did you find?
The ones who were building the Trump International Golf Course were living 21 guys to a room. They actually had a shift where people would sleep on the floor for 6 or 7 hours. Then they'd have to wake up and leave so another bunch of guys could come in and sleep on the floor. There was a kind of table in the room that had three guys sleeping on top of it and three guys sleeping underneath it. There were rats running around in the ceiling. You've got these guys living in unbelievable squalor.
Talk a little bit more about what these workers said was the difference in the sales pitch, the promise of the conditions of employment before they left Bangladesh or Pakistan, and what they actually confronted when they got to work in Dubai.
So they were told they were going to get paid $3 an hour, and that was enough for them to send money home every month. And then by the time they'd finished their contract, which is often 2 or 4 years, they'd have enough money to change their family's lives, maybe send a couple of their kids to school. When they arrived, they found out their salary was actually half of that. And because of all these other fees which they were charged, they're not even able to send any money home at all. that they're saying. We're away from our families and it's not to get ahead. We can't actually make any money until we've been here for, in some cases, 2 years. Some guys were saying 4, 5, 6 years. I mean, we also focus on the NYU campus, which is now built in Abu Dhabi. And the guys were paid much less than they were promised for 7 years.
I worked for $155 per month for 7, 8 years. We were working like donkeys.
So can you describe how the company reacted when you went on strike?
The police came. Their bodies were covered with black dress, and they all had their pistols, machine guns, and some batons.
And they beat the protesters and arrested a number and deported them. If they go home before they've fulfilled their contract, if they go home with a debt of $1,500 or $2,000, there's no way they can pay that debt off in Pakistan or Bangladesh.
You had workers that you spoke to, Ben Anderson, basically saying they had no hope.
There are some who are saying they have no life. Their life is over. They're going to work there for a number of years, and their only hope is that one day their kids won't have to do the same thing.
They gave us 70 dirham per
day. They gave us $19 per day. For this room, we pay $871 per month. You're not allowed to work for another company to make more money. Because if we work for another company, the criminal investigation department will catch us and cancel our visa and grant us no re-entry.
Let's talk about Donald Trump. He is the front runner for the Republican nomination right now. Many of the workers that you talked to were working at the Trump International Golf Course. It's a giant new golf course with luxury condos. Let's listen for a second to a promotional video that Donald Trump himself did for the property.
We're building Trump International Golf Club, and it's going to be spectacular right in Dubai, and it's going to be something very, very special.
Describe what the Trump International Golf Course is like and what the workers who built it were experiencing.
So it's described as the Beverly Hills of Dubai, a Trump International Golf Course, a clubhouse, and I think it's 100 luxury villas around the golf course, which will be run by Trump when they're completed. It's owned by an Emirati company called the MAC. Every development in the UAE has to be owned, at least 51% owned by an Emirati, so no Westerner can actually own a company in the UAE. And the workers, you know, we followed dozens of workers home each night on the buses. And after a 10, 12-hour shift, they're ferried back, often for 2 hours, because they're driven miles away from the city and into the desert. One of the labor camps we went to, it really did look like a place where you would just dump broken equipment or you know, spare materials. And we eventually snuck in through the camp boss, because each of these labor camps has a camp boss to keep the workers in order. It looked like buildings that weren't fit for animals.
An investigation into the condition of foreign workers in Dubai and in Abu Dhabi. Ben Anderson, senior producer and correspondent at Vice. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Trump in Dubai airs tonight at 11 p.m. on HBO. We've been asking you all hour long, how are you remembering the loss of Prince from Brentwood, New York? When asked, what was the best concert ever? My answer has always been the same. Purple Rain, Purple Rain.
I had the opportunity to dance on the stage with Prince in 2004. I had a client who worked as a bouncer for Prince when he came to Dallas. He saw me on the floor, asked me if I wanted to go up and dance with Prince, and I said, absolutely. And so when Prince played, You Got the Look, I was one of 25 women who got to go on the stage and dance with Prince. And honestly, it was the most amazing experience of my life. And I'm just so devastated, but I'm so thrilled that I have that memory and I will never, ever forget as long as I live.
That's just fantastic. Share your memories of Prince with us, how it affected your life, how you danced in your room. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You can always leave a comment on the website at thetakeaway.org. President Obama is in London today. He's having lunch with Queen Elizabeth II. He's helping celebrate her 90th birthday. But he's also stopped in to ask British voters to reject a move to leave the European Union. It's called Brexit, or British Exit, and the vote is on June 23rd. Now, the latest average of polls from The Economist magazine showed that about 40% of Britons want to leave the European Union. About 51% want to stay. President Obama wrote in an op-ed in the Telegraph newspaper that leaving would weaken the special relationship between the United States and the UK. Now, some see the president's visit as part of the problem.
I just find it absolutely bizarre that we're being lectured by the Americans about giving up our sovereignty and giving up control when the Americans won't even sign up to the International Convention on the Law of the Sea. They wouldn't dream of sharing sovereignty.
So does he deem
they it? Wouldn't dream of it. It's nakedly hypocritical.
That's the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, in an interview with the BBC last week. Now, for more, we turn to Bernard Jenkin. He's a member of the British Parliament with the Conservative Party. He's also a member of the Vote to Leave Board, which is leading the call to leave the European Union. Mr. Jenkin, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, President Obama said in that op-ed in the Telegraph that I mentioned, essentially, that the United States is facing the same pressures as the UK, like the aftermath of a recession, currency pressures, immigration debates, and that both countries need to resist that impulse to pull back behind walls. What's your response?
Well, this is not the United Kingdom pulling back behind walls. If the United Kingdom leaves the European Union, it means we're going to be an independent country like most countries, like the United States. And it is ironic that some Americans, not all, think the United Kingdom should be absorbed into a Franco-German superstate rather than remain independent. And it's not as though that the European Union is a great success. The Eurozone, or the European single currency, which we're not in but we're associated with, is a disaster. I mean, the Eurozone area, 19 countries share the European single currency. They have 10% unemployment. Where else in the developed world is there 10% unemployment? And we also have a migration crisis, which is sweeping across our continent because the European Union has stupidly opened its borders internally. So once you get into Turkey, once you get into Greece or Italy, you can go anywhere in the European Union. You would never dream of inflicting these things upon yourselves. And the European Union is not like a sort of club of sovereign states. It has a parliament, it has a court, a Supreme Court that can overrule the United Kingdom Parliament. It makes laws that are binding on the member states. And I say to Americans who say that we should stay in the European Union, why don't you join a single currency with Mexico and Canada and Ecuador and Peru and Brazil? Why not set them up with a Supreme Court that can overrule your Supreme Court? And why not let them tell you to open your borders to the south and the north to let anybody in who wants to come into your country? Because that's what the Americans are asking us to do.
At the same time, Mr. Jenkins, you know, there is a concern that as the UK deals with the impact of a great recession and terrorism concerns, which are real, and an immigration crisis, which is real, and currency concerns, that politicians like you are responding to populist and even protectionist or xenophobic political impulses.
No, this is complete rubbish. I'm an Atlanticist. I studied European music and European literature at university. My great-grandmother was French, and that is a ridiculous caricature. What we have is a migration crisis and a currency crisis in the European Union caused by the European Union. It's the European Union that swept away all their internal frontiers and made it easy for people to get into the European Union and then move around. It was a former head of Interpol that said that the free travel area in Europe is an invitation for terrorists to come and make their attacks and then make their escape. We found that the Paris attacks and the Belgium attacks recently were terrorists buying weapons in Eastern Europe and traveling around Europe unchecked.
Well, let's talk about the situation now, Mr. Jenkins, because there is a strong argument that a more divided Europe only plays into the hands of Vladimir Putin, who's now seeking to use divisions to attract potential members or leaving members to a closer relationship with Moscow. Now, he's not going to get the UK into an alliance, but other countries see the example. The EU is weakened by this move, and it plays into Putin's hands.
The European Union is not a democracy. It is made up of democracy. It actually takes power away from democracy and gathers itself to a bureaucracy, an unaccountable bureaucracy. That is why we've got the rise of the right in France, in Greece, in Italy. This is not, the European Union is not causing stability. It is causing instability. And that's what I think a lot of people in the United States don't seem to understand. We're not going to be like a United States of Europe in the image of the United States. We've got a much more longer and a much more complicated history. And I don't care what Putin says. I don't care what President Obama says. The British people should make their own judgment in their own national interest. That is what we will do. And I think you will find, by looking after our national interests, that's actually in the United States' national interest too.
Bernard Jenkin is a member of the British Parliament with the Conservative Party. He's also a member of Vote Leave, which wants to leave the European Union. Mr. Jenkins, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
This Sunday, it's season 6 of Game of Thrones, the premiere. More than 8 million viewers tuned into the finale of last season. Now, not everybody is caught up, and if you're not, it is your own fault. But we still don't want to traffic too heavily in retroactive spoilers here. But at the same time, the power struggles and political scheming of Game of Thrones season 6 drops right into the middle of our real power struggles of this political season. It's awfully tempting to compare those scheming Westeros characters with our characters in every newspaper and on every cable channel for the last 6 months. And so we have Melissa Locker. She's a culture reporter. She's written for The Guardian and Time magazine. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm great. So, Melissa, Game of Thrones is all about power. It's all about gaining power. We're in the middle of a presidential election. You've been doing a little bit of thinking through the parallels of power on Game of Thrones versus the real-life primaries here.
I have. And I mean, it's really hard when your news cycle is filled with nothing but Game of Thrones rumors and presidential primaries to not start putting them together and thinking about who would be who. So I've come up with a couple of ideas. Ted Cruz is clearly Stannis Baratheon.
Convince him to bend the knee.
Christ.
Or he burns.
We will carpet bomb them into oblivion. I don't know if sand can glow in the dark, but we're going to find out.
No matter. I shall take back the North from the thieves who stole it.
Everyone understands that the values in New York City are socially liberal or pro-abortion or pro-gay marriage, focused around money and the media.
You know, they're both very religious. They're both very principled. They have some big losses, but they just keep charging ahead.
And Ted Cruz does stick to principles no matter what, even to his own detriment sometimes.
Absolutely.
All right, what about Bernie Sanders?
Okay, Bernie Sanders, I'm going out here on a limb on this one, but I think Daenerys Targaryen.
When my dragons are grown, we will take back what was stolen from me.
The only way we really transform America is through a political revolution.
I fought so that no child born into Slaver's Bay would ever know what it meant to be bought or sold.
Children came from Honduras, where there's probably more violence than almost any place in this country, and they came into this country. And I said, welcome those children into this country.
I will continue that fight here and beyond.
Cult-like figure, devoted followers, no real plan to execute quite yet.
But a lot of people who believe in him.
Absolutely.
And might be ready to surprise the establishment if he's successful, I guess.
Yeah, and if you're feeling the burn, you may want some dragons on your side.
Now let's talk about Hillary Clinton. Go ahead.
Okay, so there's an obvious choice, which I don't really like, but you kind of have to say, which is Cersei Lannister.
Right.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die.
The race for the Democratic nomination is in the home stretch and victory is in sight.
No one believes this foul gossip.
Secretary Clinton, do you want to respond?
No.
I will burn our house to the ground before I let that happen.
What difference at this point does it make?
She's a woman in power. She's an insider. She has a lot of behind-the-scenes machinations. But she's also really well qualified because she has been there and seen how to really rule a country. But I don't know, Cersei Lannister, I think some big transformations are coming ahead. She had her walk of shame. But my personal take on it is Sansa Stark.
All right, Melissa, but what about Trump?
I'm risking my Twitter feed blowing up with angry people, but I'm going to say that Donald Trump is Roose Bolton.
But the North is ours.
When I look at it and I see all these victories that I have...
Wars cost money. Many people would pay a great deal for you.
I would do something very severe unless they contributed or gave us the money to build the wall.
Perhaps the safest thing to do is to kill you both and burn your bodies.
We're going to have to figure it out. We have to figure it out. We can't live like this.
I'll have a look at him.
You go to one of these rallies and you protest... Oh, you'll be in trouble.
The Lannisters send their regards.
He has no real claim to the throne, no like royal blood or insider status. There's nothing that says that he has to be the ruler, but nothing's going to stop him from trying for that throne.
Now, meanwhile, Melissa, you told me that SurveyMonkey very astutely attached their brand to the Game of Thrones phenomenon this week and some politics, too.
Right. They put out a poll that kind of pitted Game of Thrones characters against the current political candidates for president. And guess who's going to win?
I couldn't begin to.
Tyrion Lannister.
He
bested Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
It's not easy being drunk all the time. Everyone would do it if it were easy.
And Tyrion Lannister, you know who he is in real life, obviously.
Who?
He's Bill Clinton. Think about it. Melissa Locker is a culture reporter. She's written for The Guardian and Times. She's helping us fit Game of Thrones into our own real life power struggle in the primaries. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you, Don.
I am the father.
Houston, we have a problem.
I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space.
I'm having trouble with the radar, sir.
What's wrong with it?
I've lost the bleeps, I've lost the sweeps, and I've lost the creeps.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
It's Friday. It's movie day as you head to the theaters on the weekend. Rafer Guzman, film critic of Newsday, heads into the studio to tell you what to see, what to avoid. He's our movie man. Rafer, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
It's great to have you. We've got two films today, A Hologram for a King starring Tom Hanks. That's from the Dave Eggers novel. We're going to talk about that. And also The Huntsman, Winter's War, which I guess is a sequel.
Right? Prequel, technically.
All right, technically, let's start with trivia, because I like to do this when I'm here, trivia with you. Now, Tom Hanks is starring in A Hologram for the King. Let's go back to another Tom Hanks film, Apollo 13. Listen.
Houston, we have a problem.
We have a main bus be under...
Now, there's Tom Hanks in Apollo 13. Your question, what real-life astronaut is Tom Hanks portraying in this movie? Too many people forget that. Save your answer. We're going to come back to it at the end, Rafer, see if people know it. You can tweet me, by the way, if you think you know the answer. Who is Tom Hanks portraying in Apollo 13? Now, Hologram for a King, the David Eggers novel. This is directed by Tom Tykwer, who directed Run, Lola, Run, which
That's
is
right.
a great film. Here's a clip.
King is not coming today, so you guys can just relax.
Shouldn't we call corporate and let him know the conditions here are untenable?
No, Brad, we should wait until I talk to Kareem Alamod at 3 o'clock.
Do you know why we're not in that building?
Well, maybe all the vendors are in here. And maybe we're just the first.
Kind of weird being Relland and being out here.
It's a brand new city. It's uncharted territory, and we are the trailblazers.
Where are we supposed to eat?
Guys, come on! We are in the kingdom of Saudi Arabia!
Rafer, Tom Hanks travels to Saudi Arabia and finds love...
He does find that. He also finds a very strange culture in a strange new world, this kingdom that's trying to expand its way out in the desert, build these vast cities in the middle of nowhere. He's a middle-aged salesman trying to sell hologram teleconferencing technology to the king. You know, like you say, this is based on the Dave Eggers novel, so it's got a lot of layers packed into it. I feel like this film wants to say something about middle age, about America's role in the global economy, about culture clash. I'm not quite sure what it's saying exactly. It doesn't quite work for me. The one thing I will say that's very interesting about this film is it opens up with Tom Hanks doing a rendition of Once in a Lifetime, the Talking Heads song. That's almost worth the price of admission.
And I saw that in the trailer, and it is pretty great. So
yes.
I'll recommend at least the trailer to people. All right, The Huntsman, Winter's War is a sequel of a kind. As you said, here's a clip.
I thought I made you strong. How did you draw the weakness out? What did you do? What did you do? I don't have to tell you anything. Oh, but you do. You see, you said it yourself. You're something between this world and the mirror. I summoned you out. Now you are bound to me.
That is some fantasy genre drama there.
That certainly is. That's two evil queens duking it out in this one. Emily Blunt and Charlize Theron, who are both very good. I hated the first movie, and I think everyone actually really did. This is the sequel we didn't need. However, it's a slight improvement. It's pretty entertaining, overstuffed, but the special effects look great. And in some ways, it's fun. That's not exactly what I'd call a recommendation, but it's not terrible.
And if you love fantasy, then maybe.
Then maybe.
All right, let's go back to Apollo 13 quickly. I asked you, who is Tom Hanks portraying real-life astronaut?
Stab in the dark, John Glenn.
No, he didn't. He never went to the moon. He was the first to orbit. It was Jim Lovell, Apollo 13.
I would never get that.
I know. Rafer Guzman of Newsday, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Todd.
One day after Prince's death, the world is digesting what his career meant to art and music. Even President Obama issued a statement. He said, "Nobody's spirit was stronger, bolder, or more creative than Prince's." Now, many of you have been sharing your thoughts about Prince's death with us.
This is Patty White calling from Olympia, Washington. I wanted to let you know that I grew up in a very Catholic household in central Minnesota, and I vividly remember covertly listening to my Dirty Mind and Controversy cassettes over and over again. R.I.P. Prince, you will be missed.
We got this from Columbus, Ohio. Prince always acted with the utmost integrity. He was a tremendous talent and class act. I find his sudden death absolutely tragic and leaving a large hole in our culture and society. Well, the biggest loss for Prince fans, of course, is no more music. But there could actually be some comfort. Hardcore Prince fans know that the artist produced a lot of unreleased music, but a lot actually doesn't come near to describing just how much unreleased Prince music there could be. BBC reporter Mabeen Azhar is a Prince fan, enough to know just how much unreleased Prince music there might be sitting, waiting at Paisley Park in Minnesota. And so he went looking for it. Mabeen traveled to Minnesota and all over the United States, talking to Prince's friends, his collaborators, to people who saw Prince create song after song after song that he never released. Mabeen Azhar, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's great to be here.
Now, your documentary is called Hunting for Prince's Vault, and that part isn't a mystery. The vault is real, right? Tell us about it.
It's absolutely real. It's a bank vault with a big wheel on the front and a combination lock. I know this because I spoke to Susan Rogers, Prince's engineer, who set up the vault. She was the first person to say we need to collect all this material together.
Well, let's listen to Susan Rogers talking to you about the vault.
My goal was, I want us to have everything he's ever recorded. And then that's when we began planning Paisley Park, and we realized, if we're going to have a vault, let's have a vault. This is his legacy. We need to protect these things. It is a bank vault. It has the bank vault's door. When I left in 87, it was nearly full, so I can't imagine what they've done.
Susan Rogers left in 87, and there wasn't any room in the vault then.
It kept growing and growing. You know, I spoke to people from every era of Prince's career and people that he worked with. And they would tell me, not only is there unreleased studio recordings, there's also material from concerts, there's live recordings, there's video footage, there's fully produced promo videos for singles that were never released, and the videos were never released. And in fact, there's two feature films that have never been seen, and they're also sitting in the vault. So the question isn't really, does the vault exist? The question is, how much material is in there? I think one of the top lines in the documentary, and this came from a kind of semi-scientific, you could call, guesstimate that we did from speaking to all these people. We worked out through his closest collaborators that if Prince was to leave the world today, he would have enough material to release an album a year for the next 100 years.
But just the sheer volume of material that he produced, I mean, you really describe a Prince in talking to his friends and other musicians and collaborators of unrestrained productivity. It's amazing not only that so much of this music is unreleased, but that he produced so much in the first place.
He was recording all the time. Some of his band told me that, you know, even on Thanksgiving, he would be recording music. And people would say, God, why are you working today? Don't you want a holiday? And he'd say, what do you mean? This isn't work. It wasn't work to him. You know, Hans Martin Boff, who was one of his latter engineers, he told me that creating music to Prince, it was a trick. And he described it as being like breathing. For Prince.
Let's listen to Sonny Thompson. He grew up with Prince in Minnesota and played with him when they were teenagers, very, very early in Prince's career.
He was already writing great songs, very, very young. He played me this one song and it had so many changes in it, but they were all so beautiful. I was like, oh my God, man. I'm like, I'm not playing you my stuff.
Mabeen, you have other subjects in your documentary who worked with Prince in a professional capacity much later in his career, professional musicians and producers who said really he was like a spigot that couldn't and wouldn't turn off. The music just kept coming.
Absolutely. I mean, so many of the people I spoke to, like his drummer, Michael Bland, who'd worked with him all the way up to, you know, last year, he told me stories about, you know, being at home in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and getting a call and Prince's staff saying, yeah, he wants to record. And Michael would say, what, now? 3 o'clock in the morning? Yeah, sure, now. Come down. And he'd go down and they'd make music. You know, this man, Prince, didn't work like a conventional human being. He was just so driven to make music. It was as if, you know, there's a really famous quote. Prince, very early on in his career, said if he didn't make music, he would die.
The question is, can any of this music be released? Because the friends and collaborators and producers in your piece say there might be 2,000, 3,000, 3,500 songs in that vault.
Well,
can you get to
the
them?
Thing. We just don't know. We just don't know. I would absolutely, you know, take comfort in the idea that there are thousands of hours of unreleased music. We know that. I think the thing that is so difficult with this is, you know, once again, Prince is unconventional. And because he's unconventional, he wasn't signed to a major label right now. In terms of the vault, it isn't in the basement of Warner Brothers Records, who he spent years working with. It's in Paisley Park. So who owns that music? Will he have written some kind of will? Will he have entrusted bandmates? Or, you know, there was people like Larry Graham, who's the bassist in Sly and the Family Stone, who had a very close relationship with Prince. Will someone like that be entrusted to now go through this material and release some of it? Will Prince have planned what albums to put out in what years in the future? We just don't know the answer to this. Alan Leeds, who was Prince's former tour manager, I interviewed him. And he looked me right in the eye and he said to me, "Been one day Prince laughed and he said, I might just set fire to the vault. I might just burn it all down one day." One word that can really sum up his attitude to the business is control. He controls every aspect of his releases, how they're released, the formats they're released in, the promotion, all that stuff. Now, he is no longer with us. And so that control in some way, it could be argued, has been lost. And that scares me because maybe that music just won't come out.
And what would you do if they gave you 6 hours in that vault tomorrow?
6 hours in that vault would be wonderful, but it wouldn't be enough. It wouldn't be near enough. You know, Sonny T, who we heard from earlier, he said if Prince released everything from the vault, he was basically saying that there's so much music that no one could live long enough to hear all of these thousands of hours of music. But you know, the thing is, even if we don't hear another note from Prince, he released over 30 albums. He released all these side projects. He released albums under other names. That music and his legacy, I believe, will outlive us all.
Mubin Azar is a BBC reporter, a Prince superfan. He went on the trail hunting for Prince's vault. You can hear his report on the BBC World Service. And here's something to take with you today in your little red Corvette. More of your thoughts and memories of Prince, the prolific icon whose career spanned close to 40 years. From Detroit, Michigan, Prince was a fantastic bridge between R&B and rock and roll. He was one of those rare artists who created music that everyone loved, young, old, black, white, and everything in between.
This is Barry Wynn from Brighton, Michigan. I think Prince broadened the definition of masculinity for a lot of people. I attended a concert once in Capitol Heights, Maryland, where the woman in the row behind me kept hollering, "Take it off, Prince. I love you, Prince." And to her friend, "Ooh, girl, he's so fine." He was wearing bikini briefs, heels, and knee highs. But it wasn't campy at all. He made it work.
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You can comment to us at thetakeaway.org. We want to hear your memories, your thoughts. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. Blast that Prince. I know you will. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.